listening to Thinkative, the podcast for philosophers, seekers, and the generally curious, coming to you live from the farthest flung corner of Leytonstone. And tonight we've got a very special Christmas special going on. And as you can see, we're not only are we broadcasting live, but we have a special guest, Mr. Jason Alexander of the LSE, Professor Jason Alexander of the LSE, I should say. And of course, usually we've got Jason here on guitar and bits and pieces. We've got Dr. Matt Parker and me on spoons. But it's Christmas.
This is Si. This is our new family member, Si.
There you go, Si.
Named for the cyborg like.
Who's
going to
wee any minute? I can feel it coming on.
Yeah, she's going to.
Yeah, let me put you down there because. There we go. There we go,
Si. There we go. Wee. Okay. All right, we had to have a puppy for the Christmas episode, but just remember, a puppy is not just for Christmas. We're going to take care of our whole life, right?
All right. And, I think we're... Are we going live there, Jason?
We're live.
You're just checking the stream.
We're streaming.
We better get cracking, then.
Can you point the screen into the camera and do some, like, weird...
Infinite kind of echo there.
Only, of course, we've got Gavin here operating. You're watching it like in there. Gavin's operating the phone for us tonight. There we go.
Right, okay.
Right.
Great, here we are.
Jason Alexander. I'm going to have to keep saying Jason Alexander so that we don't confuse it with
Jason
the
Reed. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Jason Reed.
Jace.
We've got Jason Reed. We've got the Jace.
Yeah.
So there's, which implies that there's only one, but let's not get into that. You've brought a bottle of wine, Jason. Oh.
Yes, I did.
What bottle of wine have you brought for us?
So I have... brought a bottle of Shiraz with the rather fitting name of The Hedonist.
Oh,
excellent.
Nice.
That's great.
Call.
Actually, I think, what was the wine that Alice brought when we actually talked about hedonism or hedonism?
That was somewhere for a Greek wine, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A Greek red.
But it was also, it was named after, I can't remember now. We'll have to go
people
back.
People have got a sussed, yeah.
Go back to that, go back to the death episode. It's really good, and the wine was excellent also.
With
all right,
Alex
so this
Behoover.
Is a hedonist. The Shiraz I love, Laurel and I always buy Shirazes. Oh, is this, this has a cork, doesn't it?
Or is
it a cap?
I think it's actually...
Oh, wait,
is it...
No,
oh,
it's
a cap.
Off, it's
we
cap.
Like
oh,
caps.
Oh, thank goodness.
No, I was trying to find something that required you to go old school.
So while Matt gets the glasses, we'll just say that tonight we're talking about altruism, with it being the season of goodwill, giving, and being nice to all men. And women.
I
beg your pardon.
Careful.
Yeah, and of course, Jason here. Jason here has Jason Alexander has the professor. I might call him the professor. Has a lot of information on this because you've looked into this in quite a lot of detail into altruism in general. What is altruism at a very base level for people like me who know very little about lots of things? How would you describe altruism?
Well, the main way of defining altruism is basically a type of behavior, a type of action that you perform for someone else's benefit where you incur a cost. So the point is there's essentially no gain or advantage that you obtain from doing that.
Okay. And can we actually do that? Can we give without any reciprocation, any good feeling? Can we just be purely altruistic? Is it possible?
Well, so that's a really interesting question. It depends on exactly how you want to try to characterize what you mean by truly altruistic or purely altruistic. So people tend to differentiate between a couple different types of altruism. So people talk about biological altruism, where we can come back to that a little bit later. And then people also talk about psychological altruism, where that refers to the kind of emotions and the attitudes and the way you feel when you behave a certain way.
Okay.
The biological case is a little bit easier to think about because it doesn't actually involve emotions or mental states or any of those harder complicating features. So the point about that kind of altruism is essentially, is it possible for animals, people, or anything to behave for someone else's benefit where you incur a fitness cost? So it doesn't actually do anything conducive to furthering your life, increasing your chances of reproduction, or anything like that.
Okay.
And in terms of, are there cases of like that of that kind of behavior? The answer is yes. I mean, think about animals who give warning calls, right? if you're kind of a prairie dog and you see a predator coming and you call out to warn your fellow animals, then you're actually incurring a risk to yourself because the predator might actually come and attack you. The kind of selfish thing to do would be just to hide and let the predator go after your fellow animals.
So you're sacrificing your own safety for the good of the group.
Yes, yeah, so that's the idea. I mean, right. Basically, you are taking one for the team, right? You're not actually getting any benefit, but you're helping your other, you know, species members survive.
And the whole and the puzzle, this is a puzzle within the theory of evolution, right? Because the whole problem is, the whole idea of the theory of evolution is that you are, in effect, creatures are in effect designed, I keep coming up with these very mystical sounding words, animals are in effect designed to protect their own genes, to be, what's the word, fecund, you know, mm-hmm. to increase the frequency of their own genes, because that's how evolution works. The more you increase the frequency of your own genes, the more there are beings like you around, and therefore those are the kinds of beings that we see most often. And then if you imagine animals like being self-sacrificing, well, that seems to go against the whole basic concept of evolution, where, you know, so they're putting their own genes at risk in order to help other animals. So how could altruism ever evolve naturally?
Yeah, exactly. That's really the heart of the problem. So if you think about the phrase survival of the fittest, which is not actually a phrase that Darwin actually used in The Origin of the Species.
Did he ever say anything kind of like it?
He said things, you know, related to that, but I think that phrase is actually, if I remember correctly, it was actually coined by Spencer. Right?
Okay.
But I mean, but thinking about it in terms of survival of the fittest, that communicates the problem really, really clearly, because the moment you do something for another animal's benefit at your expense, right, you're lowering your fitness. You're increasing the fitness of the person you're helping out.
Mm.
So you would think then that natural selection should kind of just gradually usher out those helping genes, right? I mean, you eventually, you know, the less fit
the
should
prairie
be
prairie dogs
out.
That cry out get eaten. And so the only prairie dogs left are going to be the ones that don't cry out.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is the basic challenge, right? So it seems as though that the game is basically rigged against altruists. And the problem is, when you look at the world, both in terms of the animal kingdom and in terms of humans, it seems that there are a lot more kind of like nice people around than we would expect. And there are a lot more kinds of instances of altruistic behavior in animals than we would expect. So the basic problem is, well, you know, how is it possible that altruism could actually evolve? Why does it exist?
Well, just off the top of my head, someone might well say, well, look, maybe the fact is that evolution doesn't account for everything, and you know, animals and people on this planet are just nicer than they ought to be, as evolution would have it, right?
Mm. Well, keep in mind that you're suggesting this right after we saw Trump get elected, right? Okay. So, you know, the claim that people are nicer than they ought to be,
I think there's still room for
improvement on that, right? But
there
is. But because we uphold that as a real ideal, we believe that altruism is a really good thing.
Yeah.
Or I certainly
but
do.
It should be that way.
I would imagine that if you ask the majority of people, I don't know, I could be wrong. I mean, I certainly think that altruism is an ideal state to be. Mm-hmm. If you were purely altruistic all the time, if you could afford to be purely altruistic all the time, give everything that you had to people who had less than you and all of that. I mean, we're talking about more of a kind of socialist ethos, really. Mm-hmm. It is one of the ideal states of being, and it makes me think of bodhisattvas in the Buddhist religion who've attained a state or aspire to a state of being giving and caring constantly all the time.
You see also that in Christianity, right, with the golden rule, right, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Mm. That kind of, you know, suggests the altruistic perspective.
That strikes me though as a kind of impure altruism. It's kind of a reciprocal altruism.
There is that, and also just kind of going off on a bit of a tangent. Notice that
no tangent. Stop right there.
Notice that as a guide for telling people how they ought to behave, the golden rule is actually woefully incomplete, because when you say do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that's entirely consistent with someone being a jerk and wanting other people to act towards them in a jerk-like fashion, right? It kind of assumes that you have kind of, naturally, socially motivated preferences.
That's a fair point. So just because you want to be slapped on the bottom, by strangers, doesn't mean that you should go around slapping people on the bottom.
That wasn't the example that came to mind, but whatever works for you. So that's one.
I mean, so that idea of being purely giving non-reciprocally is a sort of an elusive thing, though, isn't it? Because even when you do something nice for someone, there is a psychological pleasure.
Yeah. So this is an argument that I've heard before, and I don't know if any serious philosopher has ever put this forward. Probably, philosophers say everything. If there's something that hasn't been said yet, someone will say it just to publish it.
Yeah.
But there's this argument that, well, look, when you do something for someone else, you do it because it feels good. So it's not real altruism. Mm. So real altruism in that pure sense is impossible, right? That's one sort of simplistic argument, right?
Yeah.
But what do you think, Tim? Do you think it's possible to be...
I think...
be genuinely generous?
Well, you see people out there who give up a lot of their own personal comforts in order to help others,
right,
and don't really seem, they just make sure they look after your mind and body in order to be the best functioning helper that you can be. And I do think people do that.
But are they doing it for themselves or are they doing it for others?
But what about just some really simple examples, right? Like when a stranger asks you for directions on the street, right? You tend to stop. You tend to help them. You tend to do your best at actually telling them the truth, right? You don't have to do that. It takes a bit of your time. The way social conventions work, it'd be really easy just to say, sorry, I don't have time. I'm too busy, and just continue walking on. But I think most people actually are willing to stop and help out, right?
Yeah. Just on the way here tonight, I pulled over to look at the sat-nav. The chap knocked on my window and asked if I'd got some jump leads.
Jump leads?
So I stabbed his car.
Started in Stranger's car.
On the way to the show.
How appropriate. Were you wearing Santa hat?
No, I wasn't Santa. No. I do like to theme my little trips.
Yeah.
Every time we have a show, I like to do to a care.
Oh, good.
Well, if that's the case, then we better be careful not to ever do a show on spite, right? Then you might be.
Fortunately, we've done death already.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask how that turned out.
Yeah, what happened on the way to the death show? You never told us. That secret dies with you.
Yeah.
No, but it's fine. I mean, and recently I've been being. Father Christmas at a department store, and when I'm dressed up as Father Christmas, people are absolutely delighted to see me, and you like to make people happy, and you have a little chat and you give them a little gift, and the idea of Father Christmas is very much an icon of complete altruism. He doesn't expect anything in return. All right, there's the whole naughty and nice, have you been good this year, in that case you get your presents, or have you been no, but then really he never follows through. If you've been naughty, you just don't give. You leave him a mince pie, don't you? He appreciates a mince pie, but he doesn't demand a mince pie in order to leave gifts when he drops down your chimney. And there's no with Santa, it's pure giving on that level.
Right.
Whereas, if you're talking
So we think maybe he has an agenda.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe it's all a scam, some kind of a...
Yeah, there's going to be some payback.
There is the whole naughty and nice thing, though, isn't there?
Standing in moral judgments over you.
Or maybe he has some kind of a weird tick, right? He just has this need to go and punish
the bad kids and reward the good ones because of something that happened earlier.
Although he doesn't really punish them. I mean, if you're bad, you get what? You get coal in your stomach.
You meant to get a lump of coal.
Yeah, I mean, you go back like 150 years in Britain, right? A lump of coal in your stomach, and that would have actually been like a really good thing, right?
There is the Austrian one, or Krampus, isn't there?
Krampus.
Oh, Santa's bad helper.
The dark side.
The dark side of Santa. Yeah. He actually meets out some bad punishments, doesn't he?
But you don't hear so much of him.
Yeah, I think you didn't you put up a picture of him eating someone's head?
Yes, I did. Yes, I've got some friends also to draw their interpretations of Krampus. Krampus Night.
And there's a Dutch tradition too, I think. David Sedaris does this bit about Santa, who's the Bishop of Turkey, and he comes to the Netherlands with 6 to 8 black guys who beat up children who are bad, right? That's apparently the tradition.
It's a very dodgy Dutch tradition.
It's a dodgy tradition.
But, I mean, it doesn't really sort of... we don't see a lot of that over here. I mean, as far as people are concerned, for the most part, Father Christmas is a good soul, gives a lot of stuff, doesn't really ask for anything much in return. And sort of, for me, he's the most obvious embodiment of pure altruism that we have, and we aspire to it, and we encourage our children to believe in.
Well, there's also Jesus.
There's Jesus,
I think,
but
it's also supposed to be quite altruistic.
It's pretty altruistic, but
doesn't get the gifts.
You don't get the presents from Jesus.
The case of Jesus as an example of altruism might be a little clearer than Santa, because I mean Jesus did actually die for mankind, right? So you think about maximally
he
fitness.
Didn't really though, because he got up 3 days later.
I guess the problem is that if you're an immortal god, can you really die?
There's only so
right?
much dying you can do.
So he did the best job that he could, right? So.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, okay. So very,
I'm guessing Santa is immortal, so he's not really an option.
He's been going for a long time.
But I think what we can take from all this is that our culture very much values this, very much values altruism.
Yes, indeed.
And being selfless, right? Yeah. And we're all taught this, right? We're all taught that this is a good thing to be. Mm-hmm. Now, and I think the problem that Jason is talking about is partly this problem of where does that come from, right? So does it come from evolution? Does it come from some other, I don't know, what other force could account for this, right? Or is it just a cultural coincidence that we all happen to think that it's good to give things?
Well, and also don't forget that there's this kind of odd tension when we think about what is conducive to the social good. If you think about the tradition that we see coming out of economics that says that pursuit of individual self-interest yields kind of maximally efficient markets, right? It's not through the kind of, you know, feelings of generosity or charity that, you know, the baker gives us his bread and, you know, the butcher the meat. It's people's pursuit of kind of, you know, naked self-interest that actually makes a market economy flourish, right?
Right. So there's this economic theory that makes things work well isn't selflessness, it's greed, it's selfishness, right?
Yeah, so in a manner of speaking, right? So here you actually see that kind of two very different arguments that are given towards what is actually conducive to the social good, right?
Mm. It's interesting as well. I've been thinking about Christmas Carol lately and Scrooge and the way that he's a completely mean old bastard, basically, and doesn't give anything, takes everything for himself. But in that book,
A Christmas Carol.
It's fear that drives him, because he's got locked into making lots of money so that he never has to suffer. But he ends up being a miser, but he's loaded, and he doesn't have to worry about his future. And it's when he gives up that fear of being poor and suffering, and just starts to relax a lot more, that he starts to embody and enjoy Christmas a lot more.
But that's a really interesting story. Sorry, just because actually what eventually changes him is more fear. Ghosts come and freak him out until he's so freaked out that he eventually just cracks.
Let me just kind of build on this. I mean, it's been a while since I've read A Christmas Carol, but if I remember right, isn't it the third ghost which actually gives Scrooge the images of what life will be like for other people after he dies? And he's basically confronted with this fear that he will essentially have no legacy. There's not going to be anyone who misses him after he's gone. He'll just he won't be remembered in the way that he wants. And so the transformation that ends up happening, although it yields this kind of very socially positive change, you kind of wonder if Scrooge is really doing it for the right reasons.
It looks like
right?
vanity, doesn't it?
There's a lot of different sort of cumulative reasons, I guess, that he ends up doing what he does. But it's it's that nice redemptive story, and we love stories of redemption. We love to see people transform from being having all these negative personality traits to actually having a revelation or an epiphany that allows them to become a much better, more rounded human being that involves sort of giving and caring for others, because people get locked into
even the Terminator.
Terminator 2. Oh, yeah, he turns around, he becomes a good guy,
He's a good guy then,
Well, I think that was just in his contract.
Yeah, that was just in his programming, though, wasn't it?
That's sort of like in MASH when Loretta Swit becomes a likable character.
The value of doing good.
It comes to learn. But we are, I think altruism really embodies the good side of things, doesn't it? I mean, you think about altruism, that is one of the best states as a human being to achieve.
Why do you say that?
Well, because that's what we see all these endless stories,
Our culture teaches us that.
We teach that to our children. I mean, remember, going back to that idea of like kids at Christmas, we have to teach them to be grateful for what they get and to say thank you. And because naturally it's just like, oh yeah, great, let me have that. I'll have that. Because they're very, very centered in themselves, children.
So you think that people are naturally selfish?
I think that children are, because they're very sort of centered. As you grow and develop, you're trained and helped by people who've grown out of that sense, and to open up and start to see the world, yourself as a smaller element in a bigger picture rather than the center of the universe, really.
So just one observation on that. I think that's absolutely right. And there's good reason to think that humans are sort of remarkably cooperative as a species in comparison to other primates. And part of the suggestion for maybe why humans have been so successful evolutionarily is because we do cooperate. We do act nicely towards one another. We do have this way of being able to kind of transcend our own selfish interests and so on.
Mm.
And so there's some people who think that that's actually a very deep-seated part of human nature, right? This ability to kind of break down the walls of individual self-interest and think more about the collective good.
Mm.
If you look at a lot of the experimental studies of chimpanzees and other social primates, they don't nearly cooperate to the extent that humans do.
Right.
So this isn't us.
Much worse.
Hard to believe, but it must be. Yeah, it's true by the sound of it. And that's good, because that's maybe one of those things where we're pretty cool as humans because we're altruistic, or do we look at, is that when you're talking about evolution? There's the physical evolution, isn't there? And then there's the moral and ethical evolution, which we're developing all the time. I mean, philosophy in itself is part of a quest to better ourselves, albeit psychologically rather than biologically. Mm-hmm. Aren't we looking for, we're looking for answers, and we're looking at ways, are we not looking for ways to be, to live our life better and to make better societies?
Well, some people are. I think some philosophers are just selfishly curious.
Right, okay.
I would kind of put myself more in that.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I'm not trying to help anyone, really. I'm just want to know how things work.
Yeah. But in a broad, individually, but don't you make that, but aren't you then a component of the overall philosophical drive that we have?
I mean, there's value in it. There's value in
there
it.
There is value in questioning.
Look, I want to get back into these evolutionary questions, but I do think that it is, that since this is our Christmas special, that it's time that we
have some crackers.
Have some crackers.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah,
let's have a cracker.
At this stage, the Jace is the only one with a silly hat on.
It's
not right.
Well, it's not silly.
No, it's a very dignified hat, Jason. I was being ironic.
Let's pull a cracker.
All right.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. I hope you get it. Oh, there you go. I'm pulling that now. Here we go. Yep. Oh, stop it,
there you go.
It's got glitter in.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no.
It's a
glitter cracker. We'll have to get
out the
Uber.
Yeah.
All right. You two do one now.
Here we go. Right. Merry Christmas. Oh. Yay. I've actually got something.
I got a keychain. Why didn't I get that yesterday? I needed that.
They've been sarcastic now. I've got a tape measure.
Come on, Gav, you've got to pull a cracker as well.
I got three golf keys or very ineffective plastic nails.
Three golf keys, excellent.
Plastic nails.
It's a little joke. It's a hat. There is a joke. There's jokes.
Okay.
Sorry. Wasn't very altruistic of me. There you go. That's yours. I'm up to 55 tiers. Now he's going to pull a cracker with me. Oh, here we go. Okay.
Oh, have you done one? Oh,
here we go.
God, it always fails. There we go.
Saved with crackers, folks. Great. I've got a red hat.
What do you get if you cross an apple with a Christmas tree?
No, what you get if you...
It's an apple, with a Christmas tree.
Something furry, I don't know.
Oh, you're close. What's on the little branches of the tree? What do you call them?
Fern...
Little branches.
Oh, the trail of the lonesome...
Pine.
With an apple.
Pineapple!
Hey!
Oh, I got there in the end. God. A bit painful.
It wasn't really worth it,
was it? No, it wasn't. I've got one here.
Right.
What you got?
So, who delivers presents to baby sharks at Christmas?
Santa Jaws.
Yes, right.
Santa Jaws.
I got it.
Blimey, that was a great call. What does a clock do when it's hungry? It goes back 4 seconds. That's nearly good, isn't that nearly good? okay.
Alright. What's white and goes up? The Ku Klux Klan Ballooning Club. No, it says a confused snowflake.
Confused snowflake. That's random.
That is random.
What have you got, Gav?
Hang on.
Oh, yeah.
Can we twist the phone to for Gav?
Yeah.
See what Gav's
doing. Gav in there. Oh, okay. Oh,
what's
the phone gone off?
What
have
you done, Tim?
Oh. I know, the phone's gone off. Oh, have we broken? We'll have to go back.
We have the theme tunes.
Are we still going? We don't even know if we're still streaming. Are we still live?
I don't know, I've checked.
Are we?
Sorry
about that.
All right, there might have been a bit of a break there while we got.
What do you get if you cross Santa with a duck?
A Christmas quacker.
Oh, well done.
Oh, my God. Jace, you are on fire. You are on fire tonight.
You actually wrote them, didn't you? This is your sideline.
Yes, this is actually my job. I write.
You know, you've got to fund those videos somehow.
Oh, by the way, while we're at it, this wine's very nice.
I'm really enjoying it. I always love a Shiraz.
Could we a bit more information about the hedonist?
The hedonist or the hedonist?
The
hedonists.
It may be a fine line, but to increase pleasure and reduce pain is the aim of the hedonist. It's an Australian one, but it doesn't tell me much about the... it's grown biodynamically. I made it black and silky, and it's got that long, velvety finish. True Shiraz lovers lust after. Well, that's the
right.
And if you look at the label, it also has, if that's right, a picture of a pig looking quite satisfied.
Yeah. Why is the pig so satisfied?
Well, I mean, it's the hedonist, right?
It wallows in mud, and it's
happy. Yeah, well,
but I'm just going to top my glass up if you don't mind, because
we
were worried that we may run out of wine, seeing as we've got a guest and more glasses to go around. But we do have some sherry for later, should we run out.
Should we run out too soon before we're done talking?
You don't want to peek too early.
Do you want some more?
Sure,
we'll top up.
I served myself selfishly there. Never thought of anyone else there.
Right, so.
Actually, in Japan, you always pour the other person's drink.
Do you? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Japan. There's another culture. There's another embraces generosity.
So there's this culturally, almost culturally enforced altruism, right? We're taught over and over again. And like you say, children tend to be very selfish. We have to teach them. Lord knows it's hard. Teach them to try to think of others once in a while.
Yeah.
Right? So why do we have this? Why do we have this big cultural impetus towards altruism?
What's going on there? Any thoughts?
It's what Jason was saying earlier about the good of the group, isn't it? Don't we do that because society? You know, we're formed civilizations, and in order for a civilization to function effectively, we need cooperation and we need appreciation.
Yeah, I think that's right. So, in some of the work that I do, I actually write on the evolution of morality, and I've got a line that I think explains why we have some of these social practices, why we encourage altruism, why we cooperate and have a lot of the kind of moral norms that we do.
Do help us.
So my thought is that if you think about some of the fundamental problems in society, it's that you have a bunch of people who live together. Each person has their own desires about what they want to try to get, what they want to try to realize and achieve. But all of our desires and preferences, you know, conflict at least some of the time. And what we need to do is try to find some solution that allows people to maximally realize their desires and preferences to the greatest extent possible, given the constraints placed by other people. Mm. Right? And if you think about morality, a lot of the moral rules and principles that we have give guidance so as to help kind of grease the wheels of society, minimizing conflict, trying to ensure a stable order that works well enough so that people are more or less able to kind of realize what it is that they would like to try to see and obtain and achieve, while, you know, kind of trying to accommodate those wishes for everyone.
Mm. So let me throw this back to you, see if I'm kind of getting the idea. So the idea is that a lot of our moral principles are designed to establish a kind of safe, neutral environment in which we can then pursue our own individual goals and desires.
That's part. I would probably want to say something a little bit stronger than that. I would want to say that it's not just about ensuring a safe, neutral environment, but that it actually promotes a kind of positive social order, right? That you do try to produce public goods, that you do try to generate collective goods. It's not just about having a kind of a minimal, stable, community, but you want people to throw in for the common good and try to build those public goods.
And I mean this is something that I'm just aware of from some work I did about on Victorian London, contemporary Dickens, Henry Mayhew.
He's still trying to work in that Dickens quote.
No. I'll come up with that later because I think it's great. But it's only because this is something I know a little bit about. In terms of, you know, when we became an industrialized nations, and there was a hell of a lot of poverty on the London streets and people desperately, desperately poor, a guy called Henry Mayhew went around and was a documentarian, and he went around taking verbatim transcripts of people's lives, you know, the kind of harsh, horrible lives that they led, and he published them in the newspaper, made them known. And around that time, there was a big philanthropic movement, the co-op movement, and people, and not unions yet, but there was this element of people trying to help those worse off than themselves, and as people had wealth, that came in late in the 20s, didn't it, really? I may be wrong, but certainly that idea of, oh my goodness, we've got this sprawling society going on, these cities are exploding with the industrialized nations, and we need to actually start looking out for these desperately poor people. And that was something that happened in the Victorian era. And
again, was that a fear thing?
Was it looking after the workforce?
Was it saying, oh, maybe the peasants will revolt if things get too bad?
Well, I mean, that's certainly been the case in feudal times, hasn't it? Yeah.
Well, recently, no.
People do get to a point where they've had enough, and you can actually see that now in modern politics when we had the Brexit result, and you saw politics in complete disarray because they suddenly went, oh my God, the people are on the verge of something perhaps a bit more dangerous here. And Theresa May goes out and goes, I know how hard it is for you people, you know, I know people work really hard and you've been suffering. And all of a sudden you saw a Tory with giving the illusion of having a social conscience, which of course is an illusion, complete and utter. But I don't know. I mean, I've always taken that philanthropic movement to have been quite important in the sort of development of modern society during that Victorian era.
It seems to be a very big cultural thing here too, as well, philanthropy, as compared with in the United States. You know, so for example, my daughter's school is always raising money for one cause or another, not to buy books or computers for themselves, but to, you know, give money to some other charity, which I think is strange because they could use more, you know, gear at the school. Yeah. But, you know, this seems to be a very prominent cultural thing in England that we don't have in America as nearly as strongly. I don't know why. The philanthropy thing. But, okay, but now so you were talking about, we've all been talking about being altruistic for the good of the group, right? And so this brings us back to the question, yes, but how does this happen? How does this culture of altruism emerge? I almost said evolve. How does it emerge or evolve? And does it come down to our genes? Are our genes basically behind it in the end? Or is this something that floats above our genes independently? I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think it's. I mean, you can't really say in general. I think you have to look at it on a case by case basis. I mean, certainly there are some cases where a great deal of altruism can be accounted for just by appealing to genes. I mean, so this is one of the trying to account for altruism was one of the big problems that sociobiologists were interested in. Just to give a really simple example of cases.
Sociobiologists around what time, what period?
So this would be E.O. Wilson with sociobiology in the 80s, right? So
the 1980s?
Yeah.
Okay.
So some of the examples that people give were of cases where you can give really clear genetic explanations for altruistic behavior would be, look at, say, the social insects, right, where you have just a lot of sterile worker castes, right? There you've got individual insects that will just not reproduce. Because they're not going to reproduce, their genes are basically not going to be passed on. But they spend their entire life working for the colony, right? There's really no culture to speak of, right, in the social insects. So it's all just genetically programmed in the very beginning. So that seems to be a case of a clear genetic explanation, right? And then you look at then cases of humans, and there's going to be
Let me take you back to that real quick, because... Mm-hmm. Because the genetic explanation is especially clear then there, because all the organisms, all the individual organisms, are propagating the same set of genes. They're all working together to propagate one set of genes. So it's almost like, effectively, for evolutionary purposes, that's just one individual that's promoting one, you know, one set of genes, as compared with humans, where, you know, all of our genes vary very much. So we're much more subject to effects like the sort of free rider, where one line of genes is going to do better than another line of genes because they're benefiting from not being altruistic or whatever. But with insect colonies, they all have the same genes, so the biological explanation is very cut and dried, right?
Yeah, so the insect colony case is an example of kin selection, right, where there's so much overlap in terms of the genes of the sterile worker caste and then the genes of the ones that actually do reproduce that you can basically say that the sterile worker caste are propagating, you know, other copies of their genes. They're just not, you know, passing on their own genetic material. But from an evolutionary point of view, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Right.
So cases of human altruism are more problematic and more interesting, right? And here there's probably a bit of both going on, right? If you buy what I was suggesting earlier, that there seems to be reason to think that humans are more cooperative of a species than other primates, then there's some sense in which we do have an initial genetic endowment that makes us more prone towards altruistic or group beneficial behavior. But then at the same time, when you look at the kind of the motivations that people have for why they do what they do, then those things, you know, being able to train children to not be selfish, being able to teach people to donate to charity and to engage in charitable acts. I mean, those are things that are learned, right?
So there's
a strong cultural component there. So I think it's important to keep in mind that the contrast between possible nature or nurture is not mutually exclusive, right? You can have both operating in certain cases.
Sure, and it's a gray area. There's a gray area, right? The distinction between nature and nurture is a blurry one. But okay, so I think we can account for a lot of human altruism
just in terms of culture, teaching, learning. But then we have to ask the question, well, why is our culture like that? How did that happen? Is there a biological explanation or an evolutionary explanation for the altruism in our culture? Or is there a cultural evolutionary explanation?
So what about the following? So think about the following case, right? So one argument that people have given for accounting for altruistic behavior is to think about it from not the point of view of, say, individual selection, but think about selection operating at the level of groups, right? So one way of thinking about this would be, well, imagine you've got two different tribes or two different societies, and one tribe actually works together as a group, right? So their military is you know, trained. They all are willing to fight together. They will support one another in these various maneuvers. Some of the people will be willing to sacrifice their life for others. They'll be really effective as a military unit. And imagine that contrasting a group where, you know, if people fight, they will always be looking out for their own survival above all else, right? They're not going to follow orders. They're not going to, agree to anything.
And if they keep undercutting each other, soon they won't have much of a force at all.
Right. And so now you imagine these two groups, right, going head-to-head. Mm-hmm. And it seems as though, although some of the individuals in the group that are willing to behave cooperatively and kind of work for the common good, some individuals there will be disadvantaged because they will sacrifice their lives or have to take one for the team. But the group as a whole will be much more successful in fending off invaders and so on. So it seems that in those cases, you can actually have selection at the level of entire groups or communities. That seems to provide a reason for thinking that altruism would be maintained.
So above and beyond natural selection and just that pure sort of genetic modification in, we've got a kind of moral selection, really, in that there's a way of being that is of benefit to the human race, for example, in that we tribe up, we react, we start with smaller communities, we expand our communities, we work. I mean, it's obvious for us because we're city dwellers, we live in a city of 8 million people that get along. It's an outrage when someone is murdered or beaten up or robbed, or, I mean, there's a lot of crime goes on, but we function in a huge hive society, really, and we have to come up with a set of rules and a set of behaviours and codes of practice that are conducive to living in these big societies.
But there's an argument that. Sure, that's best for the group as a whole, but it also sets up a situation in which someone who doesn't want to play by the rules stands to benefit a lot, right? So, so that it sets up an environment in which, for example, you can be a very successful thief, and so in that sense, it seems that there are forces conducive, there are forces against altruism, there are incentives not to be altruistic. Mm.
So that enforcement problem and that free rider problem, I think that is a real problem. But it's interesting to note that there's some evidence that suggests that society can actually support a kind of stable small population of people who are free riders or sociopaths. Right? Mm. I mean, I think
it
some
must be true, right?
I think
it kind of seems like the way it is. I mean, people say, they get the comeuppance, it's karma. But that never actually happens.
Yeah.
Some people do something very well with being sociopaths or narcissists or just plain evil or just, look at something like Donald Trump or something. Current example.
And also just to build off of that, I mean, if you look at the personality profiles of people who tend to be very successful CEOs, right, they tend to have sociopathic and psychopathic tendencies to a greater proportion than ordinary members of the population. Mm. So you're absolutely right that although there is perhaps some kind of group selection, some kind of evolutionary pressure for selecting these moral and altruistic tendencies, that doesn't mean that everyone is going to be able to behave that way. You can't have stable small percentages of deviants, and some of those deviants can actually do very, very well, as we've been talking about.
And then you also get that situation where you perceive the moral majority, and the moral majority take it to another extreme in that, you know, they go, it's completely wrong to consider abortion, for example, because that's not nurturing life within the society. And yet there are groups that go, but it's about the individual's choice. And so there are things that the moral majority will try and impose on the individual, where the individuals start to get, I think that we should have our rights as, you know, it's my body, I'm, you know, as a woman, and I should be able to choose whether or not to be a mother or not. And you hear that phrase moral majority
used to a lot
from America quite a lot, don't you? And there's a certain, I don't know, but there's an amount of give and take. Yes, it's naive to imagine that a society is going to be full of wonderful giving individuals who look after one another and take care of one another, and that's never ever going to happen because it doesn't work with human nature. But is there a drive? Where do you find that, you know, where do you decide what's right and wrong? Because we're talking about what altruism means, and it's about the needs of the individual over the needs of the group quite a lot of the time. I'm thinking about the homeless people that I see walking through Leytonstone, actually, who've appeared over the last few years. That's increasing now, and so, you know, and I'm not, I reach into my pocket when I can, but then there's other times when I keep my hands in my pockets and go, sorry, mate, you know, I've got, and I'm thinking about, I need to buy that present for my son.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't got a roof.
Kin selection over pure.
Yeah, and that's where what you were saying. Yeah, that idea of charity begins at home. I mean, that's also another Victorian ideal. Ideal, isn't it? That's a Victorian phrase. Charity begins at home, and you do look after your own. And we're forever on this seesaw, this moral seesaw. It seems, really, deciding between where you give and where you choose not to give, where you are kind to others and where you decide to look after number one.
It's a daily problem.
And I remember listening to a really interesting buddy, Gyawang Drukpa, talking about you can help people, be nice to people, give to people if you can, but look after yourself first. Because you need to be healthy and ready
put the oxygen mask on yourself first, and then the children.
I mean, it is. I mean, now we're kind of getting a little bit murky, you know, because there aren't always clean cut choices right now. Politically, we're in unbelievable turmoil, and I'm actually at a point where I don't kind of get it anymore. There's this polarisation. This polarisation began,
I think we're all at that point.
Yeah. And I know I'm going off on a tangent here, but this polarisation began, and there's a polarisation that at one point I could recognise. I went, this is like the polarisation in politics that I experienced in the 80s as growing up, as a teenager, and it's a polarisation I could understand. Now it's gone beyond that.
Yeah.
It's gone into something that I'm failing to articulate, and I know altruism is only an element of that, but altruism is quite a big part of that. In that you've got a lot of people with Trump, for example, voting Trump in because they go, "Oh, he's a businessman. He's a great businessman. Look, he's the kind of guy that we think America's all about. You know, he's a self-made millionaire with a million-dollar loan from his dad." Yeah. You know what I mean? A billionaire or whatever. But he stands for something that is actually quite worrying because it's very non-altruistic. It's very...
Yeah, yeah. And I've always seen this as sort of a fundamental difference between the liberal and conservative clusters of thought, which is that the liberals seem to be more altruistic, more willing to to accept taxes and help other people and help support the people who need it, whereas the conservative philosophy seems to say, no, all look out for yourselves, and if you want to give, you do it through charities but not through government.
There's some interesting work that's done by a linguist called George Lakoff, where he's looked at the difference in the kinds of language that is used across the political divide. And he finds, and he reports that if you look at, say, the left, that the left tend to speak more about, say, kind of universals or human rights, right? That they use those kinds of language of principles.
Mm.
Whereas if you look at the right, right, the conservatives, then you find language of, say, loyalty, kind of, you know, the sort of, you know, nationalism, kind of the tribal
Lovely patriotism.
Yeah, patriotisms. Mm. They find those kind of, like, you know, group identifying effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is interesting, just to kind of go back to what we were talking about in terms of, say, some of the motivating forces for altruism and so on, is that if you think about, say, how altruism is generated, one of the things we were talking about is it's the good of the group. But the problem is, where do you actually define the group, right? Mm-hmm. Where do you consider it to be, like, the local community? Do you think of it as your town? Is it your nation? Or do you somehow kind of maximally universalize to the entire human race? And I think this is part of the unease that people are facing right now. You know, so we've got kind of, with globalization, we have economics forces working at a global level, but political identities are still national. You know, Theresa May said, look, if you are a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere, right? Basically kind of hearkening back to this idea that it's the national identity that matters.
Mm.
But yet, if you think about people's individual identities, you know, that's probably even more localized and fragmented, right? I mean, especially if you have people who live... So just to take for example, so I was born in the States, but I lived in the UK for, you know, the last 15 years. So what's my identity? It's a bit of both, right? You know, I think what we're seeing right now is a time of kind of great renegotiation of how people think about their identities, their loyalties, and where that fits into this model, which group that
they need to support.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that sort of arise out of an external threat or something like that? Because people that aren't threatened don't have, like, a solid nationality in a sense. And then...
Yeah, so, I mean, there's this... So I really love social psychology, and there's one of the great... facts that came out of some early experimental work in social psychology is that if you have two groups that are actually kind of fighting with one another, that the best way to get those groups to actually join forces and cooperate is for there to be an external threat to both of them that they have to kind of join forces to try to resist, right?
Yeah.
Now, you would have hoped, at least I would have hoped, maybe some people have hoped, that something like what climate change would have counted as that external threat that would kind of, you know, help you mitigate these kind of, you know, national conflicts and so on. But it doesn't really seem like that's happened. What's happened is it's kind of, you know, kind of created greater polarization, right?
Deniers and people who are still sort of fervently industrialist and then that goes into national pictures as well, doesn't it, I suppose, in terms of the G8 summit and nations that are prepared to kind of give and take. And now slowly, people are coming around. But, yeah, it wasn't the wake-up call. It wasn't the immediate knee-jerk reaction that you might have expected when people start to see the figures.
Yeah, and we're still having a lot of trouble establishing some cooperation on this.
It's completely ongoing.
Can I change the subject a bit drastically? I want to ask this question. So we've been talking about the evolution of altruism, how we can account for even biological altruism among animals. And the question occurs to me is, why are philosophers interested in this question? Why is this not just a question of purely empirical science? Or if we talk about your broader field of the evolution of morality, why is this not a purely empirical scientific question? How does philosophy enter into this area?
Okay, so let me give probably a fairly anachronistic answer to that. But So if you look at, if you look at the role of say, rational choice and the role that reason has played in trying to think about how one ought to live. So for a long time in the high periods of Christianity and so on, the thought was that knowing how one ought to live, you know, the moral requirements and so on, were obtained through faith, right? And you basically got the moral requirements, the moral law from God. Now, of course, one problem is that if the only route to that was through faith, then that, of course, made it very difficult for kind of missionaries and so on to go on and convert people to Christianity who didn't already believe. If the only vehicle to seeing the truth was faith, and you sort of all kind of needed to be inside the group already in order to be able to have access to that. So there's a tradition then to try to show that you could use reason and rationality to get at the kind of the moral truths and, you know, the existence of God and so on, you know, without having to use faith, right? Faith was sort of the purest way of
rational existing. Theology.
But if you could reason your way to it, right, then that was another way of doing that. So making a kind of great historical leap then, you might think that, well, this then creates a general question from a philosophical point of view of to what extent can we give justifications for moral principles and the requirements of morality from a purely rational point of view, right? Where all we're interested in is what reason requires. So then you get this tradition in philosophy that tries to show how you can derive the requirements of morality from reason. And so thinking then about, say, why should we be kind to other people? Why should we behave altruistically? Why should we, you know, share and share alike? Why should we be, you know, kind to the poor and so on? Trying to come up with justifications of those principles from purely rational considerations is actually, I think, both an interesting challenge, an interesting question. It's also quite a difficult challenge, especially if you think that what we mean when we talk about reasons are that those are reasons that the individual has just from their own subjective point of view, right? They're reasons that motivate you, but if the reasons that motivate you tend to be self-interested, then the question is, well, can we give some kind of self-interested justification for why a self-interested agent would still behave altruistically, would still give to charity? Right? That's one of the reasons why philosophers are interested in these questions.
Mm. Okay.
Like with that philanthropical movement in the Victorian era, where industrialists were looking after their workers, basically, so they were taking care of people and making sure, you know, that they had decent housing and whatever, because they made a more efficient workforce. So
yeah, so that's the whole idea. Them. Yeah, the whole idea of enlightened self-interest, right? Mm. The idea that by actually, you know, taking care of your workers, you know, exercising charity, putting
you're serving yourself.
Yeah, you're serving your own self-interest, but indirectly over the long run. And it's interesting to think about how much the world has shifted from those attitudes of enlightened self-interest to then look at, say, how, take a random example, how Amazon treats its workforce, right?
Right, yeah.
I heard today that they're sleeping in tents.
Yeah, I saw it.
So they can get to work on time.
Yeah. Or, you know, and also just because they can't, they find that they find that cheaper than paying the commute costs.
Yeah,
right?
So,
and they've got to work in a huge warehouse. They should let them sleep in the warehouse.
Yeah,
plenty of space, right?
Well, they should pay them, but I mean...
Well, they actually, Amazon could cut down on their security forces then, right? If they just let all the workers sleep in the warehouse, right?
So, I don't know if it works that way.
Yeah.
The benefit to them. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing as well. We are in a strange time, I think. Yeah, we are certainly politically, and that political upheaval reflects a societal upheaval and transformation as we're kind of in the, I mean, we used to be in the industrial age, we're now in the information age, we're now in this, you know, in the age of the internet. It's a very different thing. I think it was quite interesting when John Glenn died, didn't he, the other day?
Yeah, the last surviving member of the Mercury 7 astronauts.
Yeah, the very people who were right on the cusp of the space age. I consider myself a space age kid. That's when I was born, you know, and now I look at my children and their children are the information age. And this is an age where there's an you know, it's very difficult to get far enough back to see what is going on and how it's going to pan out. And it's very frightening. But, you know, there's going to be that kind of thought required in order to corral this sort of chaotic political thinking, and especially with, you know, the way the disenfranchised and the people who are really suffering through capitalism are behaving right now, you know. And, you know, we are it, you know, we're going to be in this depression, and, you know, as much as the next man. And this, but I think, yeah, it's a difficult time to wrangle. And it's interesting, not only is it interesting in terms of, you know, this Christmas idea, you know, we said, oh yeah, altruism is it'll be a great thing to talk about altruism at Christmas, but altruism in this coming information age seems to be like quite a big question.
The information age or the disinformation
age. Yeah.
Yes, we're post-truth.
We're post-truth now.
Post-truth, what is going on? I'll tell you what's going on. I've got a tiny little present for all of you.
What?
No, don't get too excited. Don't get too excited. It's just a chocolate Santa. But there's one for Matt.
Oh, thank you very much. Oh, it's got my name on it. Are they different?
I thought I can't. I've got my glasses now. Yeah. It's got one with Jason R.
Jason, that's me.
Yeah, Jason's keen for a bit of chocolate, I could tell. Yeah.
How selfless of you, Tim.
Yeah, there you go. How giving of me.
Altruistic, just from the heart. You gain nothing from this.
We're about to chow down on the man you consider. Altruism here. Yeah.
You know, my dad used to give people gifts a lot. Yeah, and he was a big nut about Italian motor scooters, right? So he would give people scooter toys and stuff.
I thought you were going to say he gave people Italian motor scooters. I was going to say that's a very generous.
I think occasionally he did. Yeah, occasionally he did. But mostly he gave people scooter toys, right? A lot of times he gave people like Santa Claus on a scooter, Christmas ornaments and Christmas, you know, decorations. And we have so many Santa on a scooter decorations, and he passed away this year, and it was only like after he died that I realized, like, here's this chubby man with a beard who rode around on a scooter giving people toys. He was Santa on a scooter, you know.
Yeah, cool.
He was, you know, that was what he was really known for, was being just insanely generous. And an interesting case, because I think he was, you know, not to disrespect him, but I think maybe he was a little bit pathologically generous. Mm. Like, he would meet strangers and buy them things and send things overseas for, you know, shipping costs that were completely disproportionate to the gifts that he had purchased, you know.
But when you say it's kind of pathologically generous, so I guess we can make a distinction here between what actually motivates the person to behave this way, right? Because you can make a distinction between the reason that motivates the person to behave a certain way and all of the kind of emotional benefits that they get from behaving that way. Mm-hmm. So when you say your father was pathologically generous, I take what you mean by that is he seemed to get great joy and satisfaction from, you know, engaging in this kind of gift-giving behavior. But you can say, well, depends what his reasons were for giving the gifts. Maybe if he was giving the gifts for reasons other than his own benefit, then that would still be, you know, very traditionally altruistic. And then if he happened to get all of this pathological joy from doing that as a side effect, mm-hmm. you know, then, you know, better for him. Right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that there are two things here, though. One is that whatever his motivations are, a friend of ours put it very well. She said, you know, Wade, your gauge is off. Like, he's just not sort of measuring things properly. It's just, it seems like, you know, his gauge is off. And then the other thing is, the only thing I know about why he was so generous is that he once said to someone, I get a kick out of it. That was it. That was his only explanation for why he... he also used to, like, he would pass out business cards that say, if your scooter breaks down in San Diego, I will come and pick you up with my van and take you home. You know, so call me.
To his home or the other person's home?
To the other person's home. Or take you wherever you need to go for free,
just call me instead of leaving your bike on the side of the road somewhere where it'll probably get vandalized or stolen, right? Mm. And
did you see that as, so your friend said, oh, his gauge is off. Did you see that? That's altruism gone too far? Did you see that as a problem?
That's how I saw it. It was gone too far because he wasn't putting his own mask on first, right?
Right.
And he wasn't thinking about what's the best way for me to be generous. He would just meet someone, get all jazzed up about buying them something that he thinks they would like, and spend however much money it takes.
This is another thing as well. That reminds me, you know, I remember being young in London, you know, in my 20s, and meeting a couple of people on the tube one night. And I don't know why I was drunk, and I got chatting to them, and they said, oh, we're sleeping in the park tonight because we haven't got anywhere to stay in London.
Yeah.
And I went, stop at our house. Come and stop at our house. And I invited them back, and they stopped at our house. You know, great.
Bolt down the china.
Yeah. Come on in, and they never thought anything about it. And I don't know, we had breakfast the next day, and then they went off and never saw them again, didn't stay in contact or anything like that. And that was something that I did in my 20s. I don't know what I'd do it now. I mean, all right, my circumstances are different. I've got a family.
Yeah, you've got a family. You can't bring strangers into your home.
I haven't got the room.
But I think we've also become much less trusting as a society as well, right? I mean, I think about stories that my father would tell when he was growing up in the States about being able to hitchhike as a regular form of transportation.
Absolutely.
Right?
Hitchhiking.
And so, I mean, it was not uncommon for him as a young boy, you know, age 7, to go just hitchhiking from A to B in order to go places with his friends or to meet friends. And now, that would be completely unheard of, right?
Yeah, no, so my dad started doing that again this year as well. Like, before he died, he was hitchhiking around a bit. I was like, Dad, you can't do that anymore. Mm. But, yeah, exactly. It's
I'm picking up hitchhikers. Yeah, I distinctly remember picking up hitchhikers. If you had room in the, you know, even when I think we had 4 in the car and, you know, squeezed another person in because I saw him on the side of the road. You know, again, when I was young. And part of it's naivety, but part of it was just an impulse to go, oh, that guy's hitchhiking. And it wasn't really, I don't think I was thinking, oh, you know, one day I'll be on the side of the road. It was just like, oh, that guy's hitching. And it was a sort of just a knee-jerk response. And funnily enough, you talk about that, that only just reminds me, and I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but, you know.
No.
We might need a little sherry if we're going to carry on going.
I think so. I think traditionally we end the show that when we've run out of wine, and Jason actually has a sip left.
Oh, yeah.
So the show's not over, but... Okay.
Let's have a sherry.
Yeah, it's Christmas. It's Christmas. So we're going into.
I think we can. So I'll tell you the story that just told by. My friend Mac McDonald used to live in San Francisco, and he was in San Francisco in the 70s, and he went round to a friend's house, and. I don't want Max listening to this. I'm telling your story, Max, but it's an interesting story because it's related to hitchhiking.
Yeah.
And he was round at a friend's house, and his friend said, "Oh, come in, man. I've got this this girl. She's really freaking out. She's arrived in San Francisco. She knew the name of this girl called Phoebe. Somebody. She knew she was pregnant. She was going to stop at her house because she's been having a terrible time at home. You know, she's." Been, you know, there's been abuse going on, whatever, but she was in a state, and so she'd run away to San Francisco in the hope of encountering this girl called Phoebe. Didn't know her, knew this other guy somehow, vaguely turned up at his house and was in a terrible state. And do you know anybody, you know, over? And he said, oh, no, she lives in a completely different part of town. I'd never heard of her, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he asked around, couldn't find anyone by the name of Phoebe or anyone to help out, and then the next day he hitched a ride to get to the theatre where he was working on something, and got given a lift by this woman, and it
Phoebe.
Turned
Your
out
name is Phoebe.
That it was pregnant Phoebe.
Oh, amazing.
Who then he said, your name's not Phoebe, is it? She went, yeah, because she was driving a Beetle. And then he managed to get these two people together. And that's a sort of, you know, there's someone who was kind of altruistic enough to give somebody a lift, you know. And you know, and for Mac, that was a kind of little karmic proof about the way he, you know, he saw life, really, that, you know, that things like that can happen if you live that kind of life. Now, I don't prescribe to that. I just see that as an amazing coincidence and really, you know, fabulous that, that those two people got sorted out and whatever. But, I mean, there is that feeling as well, isn't there, that you can. And, I mean, we've all had it at some point in our lives, I think, that an amazing coincidence has happened or something. You've just done something from, you know, the goodness of your heart or tried to do something, and it's had what people could interpret as a sort of karmic response. You go, oh, somehow I've lived my life really as I feel I kind of should, you know, with an open heart and ready to, you know, ready to accept things. And things bounce in and out of that, and good things can happen. Mm. And I think, you know, in a way, that idea of karma is built on that kind of synchronicity and those kind of expectations, because that can happen in a random world. I mean, we're now talking in sort of random
anything can happen.
But you're saying, talking about hitchhiking there and that idea that we used to pick up hitchhikers, but yeah, society has devolved. Yeah, people don't hitch anymore. I mean, you used to be able to get a taco, you know, the not a taco, but a taco reading for that you put in lorries. And it shows you how. Oh yeah, yeah. So it's a disc, a paper disc.
Who's lorry?
Lorry driver.
No, I'm just kidding.
Lorry driver, truck drivers. Okay, yeah. Guys. Truck drivers used to have these little discs in there that recorded how far you'd driven and when you stopped the truck.
I've seen those. Yeah.
You had a paper one of those. You could stand on the right side of the road like that, just wave a taco, and you get a lift from a truck driver. You know, that little sort of those little unspoken little moment, and that was just a given. It was all right. It was like a ticket to ride. Did you heard of that? Oh, anyway.
Okay. Before we wrap up, because I feel like we might be close to time after we finish our show.
I think so.
I just want to ask Jason. So,
yeah.
As far as the evolution of altruism, what do you think is the bottom line? What's the truth of the matter in your eyes, from the gut?
So, if we're talking about humans, we're talking about what actually motivates humans to act altruistically. Mm-hmm. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that we are now at a very interesting point where the fundamental motivators are now, you know, largely detached from, you know, genetic biological inheritance. And this comes fundamentally down to questions about what we desire, the kind of world we want to live in, and the kind of society we want to create. And when we think about why it is that you know, people are nice to one another, or whether we pick up hitchhikers, whether we actually, you know, end up in these kind of pathological acts of generosity or so on. the thing is, we need to keep in mind that we live in a time where there's a lot of kind of self-interested, self-focused ideology that's around. We hear that from all of the kind of banging on about economics and the quest for economic efficiency and so on, where that kind of market mentality really causes people to become very, I think, self-centered and self-focused, and think of that as the primary measure for what is something that's worth doing. But I think that if we try to sort of, if we think about the value that can be obtained from transcending our own self-interest, if we think about the good that can be obtained through acts of charity, helping out other people, acting generously, then the point is that actually, in a very roundabout way, as we were talking about enlightened self-interest, can create a much better society that will benefit all of us, including ourselves, although it will take some time for that to happen, right? It's not going to bring about a gain for us as immediately as, you know, trying to engage in a market transaction. But the world that we'll end up generating in 5, 10, 15 years' time will be all the much richer and better for it. So the point is, the one thing that I just kept thinking about when you were talking about these examples of pathological generosity is, well, it might be the case that your dad's gauge was off, but then I just can't think and ask myself, but wouldn't the world be just a much better place if everyone's gauge was off in just same way?
Yeah.
Amen to that. Amen. Absolutely.
I think we should play out on that.
I think we should. Here's to everybody's gauge being off.
All right.
And I have to say, thanks so much, Jason, for joining us. It's been fantastic having you along. I hope you come back again, and we could talk some more and drink some more.
Sounds good to me.
Spoons? Where's my spoons?
Oh, there's one on the arm of the sofa.
Oh yeah, here we go.
All right, 1, 2, 3.